morning, Your Honors. Opposing counsel, I appreciate the chance to be here. Roger Siegel, on behalf of my client, Cecilio Perez-Gomez. There are two general issues in the case. One has to go towards the sentencing reasonableness, procedural reasonableness. The second issue, and frankly, the probably more substantial issue, has to do with the court's jurisdiction to hear the supervised release revocation. That issue itself has two specific issues, which arise from 3583I, which allows the district court to take jurisdiction or to extend its jurisdiction over a supervised release if two things happen before the expiration of the supervised release. Either a warrant or summons has been issued on the basis of an allegation of supervised release. The second, and this is the one that I'm going to spend a little bit more time on, and it's only so if it's for any reasonable period, reasonably necessary for adjudication of matters arising before the court. That's the first issue that I would like to talk about. It's interesting because most of the cases on the issue, and certainly the cases that the government has focused on, deal with supervised releasees who are, for whatever reason, detained in state court. And the courts have held well, this court has held well beyond the supervised release period. This court has held it well, and it's burdensome to require the federal government to rent somebody out of state court, out of the state prison system, which I would agree is true.
Why was it reasonable to try the drug, or to deal with the drug case proceedings before he was sentenced on supervised release?
The problem, as I see it, is that it's not necessarily dealing with the drug case before they dealt with the supervised release, but the manner in which the supervised release was transferred.
What do you think was unreasonable?
What was unreasonable was that the district court, there was a period of close to 2 months between the time that the transfer was signed by the Western District or Southern District of Texas before it was accepted by the District of Tucson or District of Arizona. And during that time, the supervised release expired. It expired on October 28th.
On the warrant that was issued, had no effect until when it because wasn't signed in front of a judicial officer. And rather than that, I know that's one of your arguments, but separate from that.
Separate from that?
Since 2 months passed, assuming the warrant was good, we disagree with you on the first position. When would the supervised release expire? What should the district court do?
The district court, first, there was a long period of time. There was, three weeks or so between the time.
Very short. He entered a plea on both of them, which is 6th of January.
And 6th of March. That was the 6th of April. That was a mistake in the government's pleading. He was sentenced, and the disposition were both appealed in April. There was a mistake raised pleading. Both were held at the same time, and that was in April of 2016.
That's when the sentencing was, but he didn't plead guilty to the drug crime in January?
He pled guilty, yes.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. He was ultimately adjudicated to be guilty of both offenses in January, sentenced in April.
The problem was that And I throw myself on the mercy of the court for having filed it at such a late date, but I had explained that I was going to be in my reply brief. I discussed some statistics that I put together with respect to supervised release revocations, which I asked the court to take judicial notice of.
So there's no, I think, do you have any argument that we can take judicial notice of a chart by a paralegal that opposing counsel didn't have a chance to even respond to?
No, I would more than with the court, and I apologize on length for Ms. Demaray. What the court says is that, and what the rule says, is that the court can take judicial notice at any time. And the fact that the case that I cited, it was the same situation where it was less than a week before oral arguments.
The chart that's put together, we have no idea if it was put together accurately or whether the sample is representative. This is not, I don't see there's any argument that we can take judicial notice of what you asked.
It's a chart of all the cases, of all the supervisory. All the substantive cases which I supervised with these cases paired with them with separate proceedings from.
And we don't know whether that's representative of how long they take when it's not a separate proceeding, when it's done in the same proceedings. No idea.
All I'm asking you to take judicial notice of is with respect to what happened with those cases that are similar to this case where there are separate proceedings.
Okay, well, let's assume we're going to have a problem with judicial notice that's requested yesterday and see what you can argue without it.
Okay, well, just to let you know, one of the issues that it has to do with the length of time that it took for the district court 56 days to accept the transfer of jurisdiction.
Why did that make any difference? Your client knew he'd been arrested, knew it was going to be a problem for supervised release, could have, in fact, turned down a plea and decided not to plea. Why didn't, it seems like your argument is he could have had an all-in-one deal, but he could have asked for an all-in-one deal just like the 50 days.
The problem was, Your Honor, that he was indicted or he was arrested on October 4th on the substantive charge. It wasn't until December 23rd, 2 months later, when after the defendant, through his attorney, had accepted the plea offer on the substantive case, which didn't say anything about a supervised release case,
Did he not know about the warrant?
He did not know about the warrant until he was served with the warrant on December 23rd. It was very brief.
So why didn't he then? So, but didn't he in December say, "I've decided not to plead guilty on supervised release. I've decided not to do a deal on supervised release"?
On January 6th, remind you, December 23rd, January 6th is the holidays. They set up. He accepted the change of plea by filing notice of intent to change his plea on the substantive case on January 18th. Before the defendant or his lawyer knew that there was a supervised release case out there, it wasn't until December 23rd that he was served with the.
Okay, so December is served. He now knows he has a supervised release. Why didn't he had entered the plea? He could still change it. It didn't happen until January.
It didn't happen until 2 weeks later over the holiday period. When I'm assuming I was not counsel of record, but what I'm assuming is reasonable to infer happened was that the parties got to the change of plea. They realized, oh, he's got this supervised release dealing. We haven't put together any kind of disposition agreement. Either that or the disposition agreement doesn't make sense because it should be an all-in-one deal. We can't go ahead with that.
But why didn't they say that?
I can't tell you why that wasn't said.
The 56 days didn't prevent them from saying that at that point.
The 56 days didn't. They were not aware until December 23rd of that. And I can't speak for what happened at the trial court, but I assume that it was only a few days before, with a Christmas vacation and New Year's vacation, a few days before.
You're almost out of time. I'll give you a minute for rebuttal if you want to save that.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Anne DeMaray for the United States out of the District of Arizona. The judgment of the revocation of the defendant's supervised release should be affirmed. affirm because the district court did have jurisdiction to revoke the supervised release. The district court issued a valid warrant prior to the expiration of the term. And the delay between the expiration of the term and the revocation was reasonably necessary. And it actually went quite fast in this case. The defendant had picked up new charges in Arizona, and the supervised release was transferred from Texas. The district court did not procedurally err also in the sentence of the supervised release. This court in Cardi has held that a within-guideline sentence ordinarily needs little explanation. In this case, the defendant received a guideline sentence of a supervised release violation. However, the court ran half of it concurrent. And I would just briefly like to address, the plea is not into evidence, but generally, the parties were aware of this, the revocation of it, that he was on supervised release, and at the time of the plea. And the issue is sometimes jurisdictions transfer, sometimes they don't. And when they did transfer, we did take care of everything on January. If the court has no further questions, I don't have anything. Thank you, counsel.
The final problem that I see, Your Honors, is that there was the time that it takes to transfer a case. All the other cases talk about transferring is burdensome to take somebody from another federal jurisdiction or another state jurisdiction and bring him back and bring him to the jurisdiction where the supervised release is pending. That was the case in Garrett. That was the case in Morales and Zabatas. This case, all that required was a piece of paper to be signed. And in the case, and one of the important pieces of information that's on that chart, and I'm not going to get into the details, is that there was the time that it takes the courts to accept transfer of jurisdiction, typically it takes anywhere from 10, 16 days, 20 days, 30 days. This case, 30 days is pushed out.
Thank you, counsel. We have your argument. Thanks, both sides. The case is submitted.